the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 199 for Saturday, April 18th, 2009.
Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek. That was actually the live in the studio, in the sub basement attic studio here in Vermont. That's actually my brother Matt playing the intro for you.
Hey,
how are you? Awesome acoustic guitar action. Awesome. Excellent.
So, John, you know, Matt is actually the one that played that intro in Go Figure that that you hear every week, the electrified version that's probably 20 years old now or what
he
have you.
He was in the band?
Of course he was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
So, nice. I'm up here in Vermont with the family. Matt and his family are up here joining us. So, John, of course, you're in Connecticut as far as I know.
Yeah, I'm going to assume that since we're talking, you had mentioned that you were undertaking a broadband installation project. So I'm going to assume, just based on the fact that we can hear each other, that that was successful, because I don't think we can do that over a modem.
No, not with the quality that we can hear you. That's right. Yeah, so Matt and I will talk a little bit about this. My dad has this condo here at Mount Snow, a Green Spring Resort, actually, a lovely place with a mountain view that you can see. Yeah. A picture I took on TwitPic. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so he's had this place for years, and it's always a dial-up connection when we come up here, and it works, but, you know, it's dial-up. And so he got his, you know, his stimulus bonus and his paycheck or whatever it was, and he said, that's it. I'm going to add Wi-Fi to the condo, and perhaps, you know, it'll increase rentals and all that stuff. In fact, if any listeners want to come up to Mount Snow, let us know. We can probably hook you up with
because before you and I would share the phone connection with a base station that either you or I brought.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think email was doable, and maybe basic surfing, but beyond that, yeah.
Oh, it was a train wreck. Yeah, so let's face
go
it.
On. But yeah, call Dave if you want a nice place, awesome place, really, really a nice place to get away from it all.
It is, yeah, and if you ski, even better. So they had the cable modem installed last week, and so we had this interesting dilemma because, and Matt,
who is it Comcast or is it like some local?
I don't know.
I never heard of. Or?
It's Sovernet, I think.
Yeah, Sovernet.
Yeah. Here, I'll try and get the mic a little bit closer to Matt so we can
okay.
Share here.
No, I'm just curious. So it's sounds like a regional bunch, or at least I haven't heard of them.
Yeah, and it seems to be a 2 megabit down, 512K up connection from what we could tell. But, you know, the thing is, it's a rental. So we want the renters to be able to use the connection, but only the renters that are here. So we need to set up a passworded Wi-Fi connection, right, John? But, you know, my dad – and so they want to be able to change the password on a fairly regular basis. But my dad doesn't want to have to change his password on his computer. He just wants to come up and wants it to work. And he didn't want to spend a fortune on two routers or a router with two radios or anything like that. So we started getting creative. And Matt, I'll let Matt talk about the solution here because, you know, you people sometimes laugh at me when I rant and rave about the DDWRT firmware that I like. But you know, it actually helped solve this problem this time.
Wow.
And so we bought a WRT150N router, which is a 2.4 gigahertz wireless N router. It seems to work fine. Obviously it's working right now. Yeah, you want to see my screen here, Matt, since your computer's not working?
Sure. All right, you can get close. Tell them what you're looking for here. So what we did is we set up a virtual interface so we can have two SSIDs broadcasting in the condo here. And one of them we can have for family setup with a password and SSID that's unpublished but never changes. And one we can set up for the renters, which is published. And by using the virtual interface, we can have two SSIDs.
On a single radio, which is actually pretty cool.
Right. Okay, so to translate what he just said, though I got it, but just to translate it down a bit, SSID is the name of the base station. Usually in your airport menu, that's where you're going to see that. And then I think what you said, Matt, is one is published or beaconing or open, which means it'll be seen in the list. And then I think what you said is the family one is the one that will not broadcast or beacon, which would be harder for someone to find.
Exactly right.
And so if they wanted to, so I'm sure it's some wacky, or it's just something that, that somebody wouldn't easily guess. Oh, but that's awesome. I didn't know you could create two different radios or two different IDs from a single radio, unless I had two radios. I don't know.
Yep, no, same radio, same channel, and two different SSIDs. And I guess, Dave, these are BSSIDs?
Correct. It's not just different SSIDs. It's different BSSIDs, which sounds like a single letter put in front of the acronym. It might mean nothing. But what it translates to is they advertise as two different MAC addresses, but which helps they say there's a lot of mobile devices that'll get confused if you do multiple names on the same MAC address. But this will actually broadcast different MAC addresses. Now, it just starts guessing at other MAC addresses, but it seems to work just fine. So.
Yep, and we're up and running, broadcasting on that hardware.
Pretty cool. So that's the DDWRT firmware. So it's a Linksys router, but the not the standard firmware. And this is probably something that, you know, not everybody would want to do. But, you know, if you're – maybe even if you're in an apartment or if you have friends that come over to play games or whatever, you know, you might want to have two different SSIDs or, of course, if you have rental property. So anyway, I figured we'd mention it. The experiment was a long time in the planning, in that we had to figure out exactly what we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it, but the implementation was cake. So that's good. Right? That's good, John? Right?
Awesome.
All right. So we have a what I'll call a normal show, if such a thing exists anymore, John. And why don't we start with Tim? And hopefully the sound works, but if it doesn't, you won't be hearing this anyway, folks. So yeah, here we go.
Hey, guys. Tim from Chicagoland calling. I've got a follow-up question to podcast number 193, all your juicy info regarding partitioning in regards to Apple Partition versus GUID and Master Boot Record. I have a all-Mac network, although my network consists of both PowerPC and Intel-based Macs. I have an Airport Extreme base station, not a time capsule, but just the regular base station, with a 750 gig drive hanging off of it. My understanding is that the partition type only really affects the boot capabilities of the hard drive. And my question is, if I'm hanging this drive as external network attached storage, does it matter which partition map I use? And if it does not matter, would you recommend one over the other? Thanks, guys. Wonderful show, and we'll keep listening. Thanks.
All right, John, you want to take this one?
I'm going to say that I don't really know if it matters. So it definitely does matter. If you're considering a disk for starting up your computer, then you absolutely have to be using the right type, which is depending. And let me see. I have a little note here. So PowerPC Max, Apple Partition Scheme, GUID for Intel Max, all that great stuff. And then for PC, it's a SMB or MS-DOS.
Say that again, John. You sort of mumbled through that. Yeah. So for
okay,
PowerPC
Mac, Apple Partition Scheme.
Okay.
Intel Mac, GUID Partition Scheme.
That's GUID.
GUID.
Got it.
And then for PC would be the MBR, right? Master Boot Record. I think are your three types in there. Yes.
That's right. Yes. Okay. And the Mac can read and write to and from all three of those without any issue. And in fact, on all three of those, even on Master Boot Record, I think you can put an HFS partition on there, correct?
I'm not sure.
I believe you can.
I don't do that.
Right.
But you could.
Yeah.
I don't think it matters, but I guess my suggestion would be that you use the type that is most appropriate to the OS that you're usually going to be using to access that thing. So That's kind of my spin. I just naturally go with the Mac partitioning scheme because that's pretty much what works on all the equipment, including the Time Capsule or the Airport Extreme. So
Right. Yeah. My advice would be, yeah, it doesn't matter if all you're going to do is hang it off and use it for storage and never consider booting from it, except that if you use Master Boot Record, as we've discussed, I believe the maximum partition size is 500 megabytes. So if you want to obviously use more than that, if the drive has more than that, then doing Apple Partition Map or GUID would be the option. But really what I would do is I would pick the machine that if you were to change the purpose of the drive, so repurposing it from being a network drive to being perhaps a drive you might want to back up your hard drive to and perhaps boot from if you ever had an issue, you know, with your main drive, well, then you probably want to make sure that it's going to boot your main Mac. And that's really what I'd use. So if you're using an Intel Mac as your main Mac, and probably, I would say most, though certainly not all people are, I would choose GUID, and then that way you're good to go, you know, for the future for the future and beyond.
Yeah, you know, there's something in the back of my head where I remember, and I think they've resolved it in the current firmware, but it was something having to do with if you used one of the partition schemes, there was some limitation when it got over a certain size, I think, and I'll dig through my notes, but I think you may recall this too. It was early on, and I think it had to do, all right, if you're using this partition scheme, everything may appear to be okay until you try to store more than a certain amount of gigabytes of data. Then things kind of fall apart. So let me find that. So I think that may have been specific to the time capsule. So,
Does
sound familiar to you at all? Or?
Sort of. Not. No, I'll say no.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it's not true. all right. You know, before we move on to Tom, there was actually one thing I wanted to talk about in the intro. Of course, we discussed this show is show 199, and though we had the custom live intro here with the theme music, next show has something special about it too, which is it's show 200. And as we discussed, the plan is to do it live. We're still working out the technology, so what you're going to need to do is read MacObserver.com on Monday the 27th, and we will have instructions there about, you know, what we're doing, how you can get involved, and how you can interact with us. And we will, assuming we can do it live, we will take questions live. Bring any question you want. You know, we're looking to have we're happy to be informative with this show, but we're also happy to have some fun. So if you want to ask some questions of John and I that aren't necessarily Mac related, but perhaps show related, that's totally fine. So, you know, play Stump the Geek, kind of like we've done at Macworld, John, where if the answer's not right there, it's not right there, and that's okay.
Yeah, those were good. I like those.
Yeah, lots of fun. All right, we talked about AppleCare last time. And Tom wrote in, and we have some clarification and some additional details. So when you mail in computers into AppleCare, there are no mail-ins on desktop machines. So no iMac, no Mac Pro. The iBook, MacBook, MacBook Air, and PowerBook G4 12-inch go to Memphis, Tennessee now. All the other laptops go to Houston, Texas. The $75 backup data option that we discussed was discontinued about a year ago. There is no longer any backup or copy option on AppleCare mail-in repair. Now, I'm editorializing here. I don't know if that's an option at the store. I believe it still is an option if you bring your machine into the store. Many times when you bring your machine into the store, they will send it out to either Memphis or Houston if it's not something they can fix right there in the store. Another thing that Tom mentions is that he says normal out-of-warranty repairs have a one-price-fixes-all flat rate. Accidental damage repairs have 4-tier levels based on parts needed. Also, cinema displays use a mail-in repair strategy and go to Louisville, Kentucky, or Louisville, if we're saying that right. Is that right, Matt?
Louisville.
All right, there you go. So this flat rate repair, John, this is good to talk about, right? Because it's not something that is overly advertised, though they certainly don't try to hide it. If you are out of AppleCare and you are out of warranty and you need to send your machine in to get something fixed, they have what Tom refers to as their flat rate repair. And you can pay, and I think for a laptop, it's not cheap. It's like maybe $350. So it's about the price that you would have paid for AppleCare, maybe even a little bit more depending on where you get AppleCare. And that then qualifies you to have anything that is not related to damage, you know, physical accidental damage to the machine fixed. I've sent a machine in for flat rate repair and gotten, you know, the screen, the keyboard, the motherboard, and the DVD drive repaired or replaced.
I think I've heard of cases where unless like you take – so that's – okay, that kind of covers what I was going to say. But unless you take a sledgehammer to it and it's like you send it to them in pieces –
There is one other thing that they will test for. I believe, right. Like all cell phones have, the newer model MacBook Pros, yes. And perhaps even the MacBooks. You know what I'm getting at here, John? Immersion detection. I like that. Yes, it's a little paper dot that turns bright, goes from bright white to bright red as soon as it gets wet and never goes back. So they can believe they know if in fact your damage is due to water. And of course I say this after I just put a glass of water down next to my laptop, which I'm going to move. You can talk to them while I move my water, John.
Hi, Dave's drinking water and Dave's going to be right back.
You back, Dave? I am.
That's good.
That's good, right? Maybe like that's the point where we do this, right? Now I can't get it to stop. Seriously, I can't get it to stop. Oh, there it is. Okay. I don't know why I couldn't push the button.
There's one other that one of our listeners dared us to play, but...
Oh, I don't have it queued up.
Keep going.
Yeah, so sorry about that.
You could find it.
No, I don't even have my iTunes drive plugged in. I could not. all right, this is as good a time as any. Our first sponsor for the show is Circus Ponies with Notebook 3.0. We've talked about Notebook many times. You've all heard about it if you're regular listeners to the show. If you're a new listener to the show, Notebook is an electronic notebook app where you can create multiple documents, i.e. notebooks, for different topics, different subjects. You can create anything you want in these notebooks. Then you can pull in PDFs into the notebook or type in an outline view. You can draw diagrams inside the notebook. And we actually got some feedback from Carol. And she said, my first question, one of the features in Notebook, which I might add you have not mentioned, is the ability to record meetings and take notes as you are recording. Once that is done, you can then go back to the exact spot on the audio where you have made the note. So this is actually very cool. So you can record the notes, go back in, and then listen to perhaps you were taking notes in the lecture, and as you were typing, of course, recording the actual lecture that you were hearing, and then you can go back and augment your notes or perhaps clarify things and all that. So Notebook is the kind of thing that basically works the way you want it to. You dump all your data in there for a given subject, and you can have multiple notebooks open. You can search from either just in one notebook, or you can search across all the open notebooks. So lots of options, all available at circusponies.com. Of course, you get a 30-day fully functioning free trial, and then it's $49.95 if you own an older version of Notebook. It's $24.95. So that's circusponies.com with Notebook version 3.0. Is it time to talk about to go from Notebook to iBook, John?
Right.
Okay. Now that I screwed this all up with Linus and Lucy there. Mm-hmm. Did you know that, John, that's the name of that song?
That is the name of it?
Oh. Yeah, that's the name of that song, Linus and Lucy.
I didn't know that.
You did not?
No.
Does anybody know who wrote and played it? Anyone? Quickly?
That would be Linus, right?
Well, in the show, Linus played it. But
it was a popular jazz piano piece written by Vince Guaraldi and...
Wikipedia to the rescue here.
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay.
That's that right?
I believe it's just Vince Guaraldi.
Guaraldi.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, Joe writes, I have a question. My son has a 14-inch iBook 900 megahertz, model A1007, that started out with what seemed to be a bad battery, i.e., it started out holding only about a 30-minute charge and eventually would not charge at all. After some PMC resets and playing around, I managed to get a full charge on the battery. However, now the iBook seems to be mostly dead. Upon pressing the power button, I get the dong and immediately a white screen. I can even get the option Apple PR reset to function and an external FireWire to power up, but never anything else. No apparent hard drive spin up, no FireWire boot drive access, and no bootable CD come up. There's no indication on the screen that anything is going on, just pure white screen. In the desktop world, I know there's a little keep alive battery for basic settings. That can cause weird behavior of a Mac starting up. What I don't know, however, is if laptops have this battery or if in particular this iBook does. Any ideas would be appreciated, and being such an old Mac, carrying it to Apple for a repair would be like totaling a car. Just not worth it. Okay, so let's go and answer his second part of his question first, John, because I know you did some research on this about this backup battery. Let's talk about what it is and then whether or not he's got one.
It's a battery that will allow the computer to store certain settings like time, date, and some other fun stuff, maybe configuration information. The thing is, not all computers have it. If you look right here, I'm looking at article TA25911. Portable computers, models which do not have a backup battery, and that includes iBook, all models, iBook G4, all models, and my last portable, the PowerBook G4 12-inch, all models. None of these machines have a backup battery, so if you lose the juice, it's wiped out.
Right.
Or there's not a chance for an area of memory that was being backed up by the battery to get corrupted. On the other hand, and I think he hinted at this, is that there still is a power manager reset procedure. And it differs by machine, and we also have a link to that whole article about that. In a lot of cases, it's a button somewhere. In some cases, it's a key press or something. So,
all right.
Your thoughts?
Okay. So he does not have this backup battery in the machine. But that would cause problems like this. In fact, in one of my old iMacs, it would not start up. And what I had to do was replace this battery, and then everything was fine. So, you know, that the power that lets the computer see the little startup button, that's all run by this backup battery. So, so my thoughts on this are, you know, I wonder what would happen for Joe is if he plugged it into power and removed the battery entirely, right?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, it sounds to me like this computer has a bad battery, a normal battery, the one that, you know, that powers the laptop.
Well, first off, yeah, it sounded like its lifetime was pathetic.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like the lifetime has gone so far low that it's not even passing through enough current regularly to get the machine to boot up, right? I think you yank the battery and see if the thing will start. Now, I think most Apple laptops will start correctly without a battery in. And in fact,
so my wife has a G4 laptop and has a battery that has expired. It won't hold a charge. We've started it up for sure without a battery in it.
Okay.
Just to test to see if it was the battery or not. As soon as you unplug it, it will die if it even has the battery in. And I'm wondering if that happens, could you have damaged the operating system to the point where now it's having trouble starting up even if the battery's in?
Well, yeah, even if he corrupted his OS, it would still try to boot up from a boot CD or whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
So unless he fried the motherboard, which it doesn't – anything's possible, but it doesn't sound like it, only because it's starting to a point. But who knows? Yeah, it could be a damaged motherboard. Yeah.
Right. But I found here –
I'd yank the battery.
And I found this. So the power manager reset for this machine, or at least most of the iBooks, is there's no button. Make sure the computer's off. Reset the power manager by simultaneously. Now, okay, you got to be kind of coordinated – Shift, Control, Option, Power. Hold that down, and then wait and hit the power button. So that's like a last ditch if something did get corrupted. I mean, with the battery out, I would think there may still be some latent, you know, some capacitor or something that holds on to some data, or maybe some NVRAM or something like that. I don't know.
All right.
Hello?
Yeah, we're here. We're good. If you can picture this in your mind's eye, we're in one of the bedrooms here, because the kids are asleep, of course, in the two other bedrooms, and our wives are downstairs watching TV or probably conspiring against us somehow.
That's what I suspect.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And so Matt and I are up here in one of the bedrooms, but there's no desks in the bedrooms here because there's a big living room. It's a big condo. So, you know, it's not like a hotel where you would actually put a desk in a bedroom. And so we brought up this little table to hold the microphone at mouth level, but of course it means that we're sitting on the floor. So we're sort of in a let me say it this way. I don't expect this show to go an hour like some of them have.
Good. Well, you let me know when you want to throw in the towel.
Okay. Okay. I'm not quite ready yet.
I'm in the uncomfy chair, so you know, sorry, I'm not going to sit on the floor though. I refuse to
put
myself down to your level.
We also realized that we're completely out of beer before we started the show. Not that that has any bearing on how we record the show whatsoever.
Certainly
ever.
Not.
Certainly not. That's right. But it might mean that my throat gets dry. We should read about Bob though.
Bob.
What about Bob? So Bob writes, I have been listening to your podcast for nearly a year now and have enjoyed the subjects and news covered. However, I've noticed that when it comes to comparing OSs, it's been Mac OS versus Microsoft OS, i.e. Vista, XP, etc. Why have you not compared Mac OS with Linux OS? Great show. And whatever. Okay. Lots of kudos. Thanks, Bob. Yep. Good. All right, John, you want me to take this one first? Do you want me to run with this, or are you ready to go?
Flip a coin. I don't know, man.
All right, you know what? You took I think you took the last one, right?
Yeah, you go.
All right. I don't know what I'm going to say though. No. You know, I don't bring up Linux. There's two reasons. One, and this is sort of a cop out, that it's not typically mainstream enough. And that's BS, because, you know, it's probably way more mainstream than the firmware that I run on my router, and I certainly talk about that a lot. So, we'll throw out option number 1. Excuse number 2 is, and this is actually true, I have very little non-command line experience with Linuxes. Now, we run TMO. It runs on a series of Linux boxes, right? I mean, that's what it does. And I've been using Linux for probably the last 15 years on, if not daily, you know, certainly multiple time per week basis. But it's all been command line stuff. So I don't really compare the two in terms of an OS that I would use on my desktop, though. That's only because I don't do it. It's certainly a valid OS to use on your desktop. There's lots of reasons to do so, and there's lots of good options available. I'm just not familiar with them. I'm familiar with the names, but beyond that, I couldn't tell you, you know, what the difference is between KDE and GNOME and all of that stuff, or even if the two are somehow related. So that's my excuse, John.
So I've dabbled a bit, but I guess you know, my feeling is that there's so many different versions that it's hard to, which one do we talk about? Like, two that I've used as of late that work. I was doing some work with imaging APIs and wanted to see how it worked under some form of Linux, and I got Ubuntu.
Sure, I've read it a million times. Yeah,
and then some other folks who are doing product development are using SUSE Linux, so I got that just to replicate the environment. But they're also using these things, which I don't know if you've seen them, but I actually built a system with one of these. But Intel has this desktop board, they call it. It's a D945GCLF. It's basically a self-contained computer on a circuit board. It's like under $100. It's an Intel, you know, 2 gigahertz, I think, processor. It has USB. It has VGA. It has onboard graphics. You can put it. It has one RAM slot. It has USB. It has Ethernet. Buying a case and a power supply for this is probably more expensive than the machine, than the motherboard itself. This is not aimed at power users, though. This is aimed at, and a lot of their literature actually shows, you know, pictures of people in countries that don't have a lot of computers, basically saying, and I think their tagline one is like, you know, this is going to be the next billion computers. So that's what I've run this on. Now, the danger, though, that I ran into, which is always the bad news with, you know, the fragmentation of all the different Linux versions, like one of them, for example, it installed using this Atom motherboard, but I had, I think, a Realtek Ethernet chipset, and the machine was like, huh?
Right.
Now, a lot of OSs installing without a network connection is bad because it can't check for things like updates or do anything really useful, in my view. Now, what worked out, though, is that now always keep your whole old hardware, kids, because I had an old, I actually pulled it out of a Mac, but I had an old PCI Ethernet board with an old DEC chipset on it. I put it in that machine in the PCI slot. And the OS was like, oh, okay, I know what that is. All right, let's go.
That's great. Yeah, yeah, that I've run into that. You know, I don't currently run a Linux machine in the house, but it's probably been less than a year since I have not. Up until then, probably for the last 10 years, I have run a Linux machine to do most of the management of my network. Now I'm doing it on an OS X server machine. But yeah, you know, building those, it was always – what hardware do I have access to that I know I have the drivers for or the drivers are built in for? And it's always this very, you know, tenuous thing. And when you do updates, especially, you know, big, you know, wide-reaching kernel updates or whatever, there's always this concern of, okay, well, is it going to, you know, stop recognizing my network card is the worst because I always remote into the thing. So if the network card goes, it's, you know, it might as well be a brick, right? It doesn't matter. But yeah, no, it's true. But yeah, yeah. So I don't. We certainly can cover Linuxes as they come up, but don't expect us to change our tact here. But it was a good question, and Bob, you're not the only one that has brought up that subject, though. You probably asked it the most clearly. So it was a good opportunity for us to answer the question. So Bob and Joe and Tim and Tom and everybody has contacted us. John, let's tell the rest of the folks how to contact us for, well, at least all but show number 200, right?
What are you talking about?
Well, show number 200, we're going to have this live thing. And
oh,
so
you keep saying that. Yeah.
I do keep right, saying that. Whatever. If we can make the tech work, yeah. And I, you know, if we can't, come on.
All right, but if I wanted to call us, I would call us at 206-666-GEEK.
That's right, which is 4335. And you can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com. And that is the best way to email us.
Yeah,
trust
me on
this.
That was feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Did I say feedback@macgeekgab.com?
Yep. And you can, you know, just if you're feeling lucky, you could try to Skype us.
I think I fixed that again. What happens is the Skype thing, it for some reason it gets into a funk where it will only accept calls from people in our address book. And I go and I change that option, say no, take calls from anyone. And then it works for a little while, and then somehow it gets, you know, set back to only accept calls from people in your address book. Because we don't have anybody in our address book because it's never on. So that's sort of the issue.
Right.
Yep. And then we love the iTunes comments. We really do.
Do we? I do.
Okay, good. All right, I'm going to vote that we skip down on the agenda to Brad, John.
Yep.
You okay with that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, why not?
All right.
All right, we'll do – you know what? We've been talking about Linux, so we can do this Tom thing, right? Troy, right?
Troy.
That's what I meant. Yeah, sorry.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Troy from Dearborn, Michigan. I'm a loyal listener and a sometime caller, and I'm calling for some advice today. We have an older G4 that runs at 533 megahertz that I'm trying to convince the kids and the wife to use instead of the iMac. But it's running really slow, and it doesn't do everything that we want it to do. For example, reading PDFs in line, it won't do in Safari. We have to download it first. So I'm faced with three choices that I can see. One, I can wipe it clean and reinstall Panther. I have Panther. Two, I could do some hacking and install Leopard because I have a copy of Leopard, but since it runs at 533 megahertz, it's not officially supported. Or three, I could go radical and install Ubuntu on it, which just kind of sounds like fun. But I'm looking for your advice because, you know, I wouldn't want to get caught.
All right, I'm gonna throw my advice out real quick. I think Ubuntu would probably be a whole lot of fun, but if you're trying to convince your family to use this, you know, they might not see it that way.
Fun is very subjective.
Yes, that's right. Fun to install. I'm sure easy to use. I've heard good things about Ubuntu, as we just said. But
maybe fun to explore, but yeah, that's not everybody's bag.
If they want the Mac experience, you know, I'm sure they're going to come up short in some way. So I would actually go the Leopard route, unless you can get your hands on a Tiger disk, which would probably be the best of all worlds in your situation, but not if you have to go out and buy Tiger.
Yeah. Now, there's a little problem, though, I think, right?
Yeah, go ahead. Talk about the problem.
Well, the problem is Leopard, in its infinite wisdom, or not infinite, whatever, I think in order to guarantee a pleasant user experience, it will look at the machine, and if it determines that your machine is too wimpy, it'll say, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And I've had this happen, so... what you have to do is you have to fake it out. Now, there are a number of ways to do this. One is kind of geeky. We will link to a low-end Mac article. But basically, you can go into Open Firmware, which is something on the older Macs. It was kind of like BIOS, or you just low-level stuff. And basically, you can go in there. When you boot the machine, you get a prompt for Open Firmware, and you can basically trick the computer into thinking that it's a different machine from what it is. So that's one way to do it. And I think that extends, actually. I think you have to actually hack an installed disk along with that. So, but then there's another link I have where somebody actually wrote a program called Leopard Assist, and it basically takes care of all this stuff for you, so you don't have to screw around with the command line or anything. The only warning is that, you know, I mean, I think Apple makes the judgment about what machine is appropriate in good faith. So if they say your machine's not going to handle some stuff, it's probably not going to handle some stuff. Like, I would not expect to be doing, you know, full screen, full motion video on one of these older machines.
Okay. Right. So we have a we actually, and I didn't even realize this when I prepped the show, knowing that Matt was going to be here. But we actually have some real world experience with almost exactly this machine. I think he's got a your wife's machine's an 800 megahertz G4, so slightly faster than this, but
that,
still
I think is the threshold of machines.
It was right below it. So granted,
it's 880 or something. Okay. Yeah,
it's not exactly this scenario, but if you can get your hands on a supported machine, you put your target machine in FireWire mode and just install it from the supported machine. And voila, unplug the FireWire, and the unsupported machine comes up thinking it's Leopard. And that's it.
No,
there was no complications. In fact, I have a FireWire drive with Leopard on it that I keep around, and I just booted up, daisy chain the old machine into that FireWire drive with the install disk on it into the supported machine, run everything from the supported machine, reading the Leopard install off the FireWire drive, installing it onto the target machine that's unsupported.
Wow. Well, that's pretty easy. And it sounds like Tom's got I said Tom because we talked about Tom before. It sounds like Troy's got other supported, you know, Leopard supported Macs. So I think that would be the simplest route. Now, the question is, and if you had something else to add, that's fine too. But my question will be, how does it work on her machine?
I haven't seen any problems. There was something about
like QuickTime. To me, the biggest stress test is full screen, 30 frame a second QuickTime. Like movie trailers.
But isn't that going to work the same whether it's Panther, Tiger, or Leopard? I mean, I think the issue is OS services, right?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had any trouble with QuickTime. There was one thing about the transparency of the dock that didn't show up, and that was a difference that I saw. But so other than that, it behaved like a slower machine, which it was. Yeah. And I didn't notice any issues, you know, with the with the operating system, and in fact, my wife didn't either. Who didn't actually realize what I had done. She noticed some of the interface changes, but never had any any major issues with it. So
okay, it's working. So for normal use, but I would imagine like you weren't gaming with it or anything.
I was not gaming, but I wouldn't have gamed with it anyway, probably because you know, I would have noticed other issues just with gaming in general.
RAM is an issue now with Leopard. Does Leopard itself take up more RAM than Tiger, which I know she had on it previously?
It does take up more RAM. That machine actually had the supported amount of RAM, but not the supported CPU.
Okay. But even still, she's probably RAM starved on it, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So that there you go. That's the at least some real world info.
Really?
Really? That's what we say.
And we're keeping it real.
Keeping it real. Should we move on to Brad? Before Matt and I are crippled here from sitting on the floor.
Yeah. Okay. One more.
We can do Brad, and then you know we should follow up with the cool stuff found, right? Because we should wrap up doc thing. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let me find Brad. I know I have Brad. Okay. Brad says hopefully a quick question, which you probably have touched on in your previous podcast. I'm sure we have. I have four Macs, which all independently connect to the internet via a Wi-Fi router. One of the four computers is a new MacBook Pro, which sometimes hooked up to my local network via Ethernet-only router for a speedy connection in transferring and syncing files between machines. Other times, it's on the Wi-Fi router in other parts of the building. The question is, how do I ensure that when it is hooked up to Ethernet, that it's using that mode to transfer files versus the slower Wi-Fi? Each computer is on DHCP and could use manual addressing for both Ethernet and airport. Would this speedier Ethernet connection be ensured by entering the specific IP address for the local Ethernet computer? If so, what is the best way to save these addresses? And he goes on to ask to offer many different options, none of which would work. So we'll skip to actually providing a helpful answer here. So the idea is we have a machine that sometimes connects to a network via Wi-Fi and other times connects via Ethernet. But when it's connected via Ethernet, we want to make sure that it's talking over Ethernet. And John, if you don't have the answer, I do, but I think you've got it right there, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think it has something to do here. Yeah, we I guess both knew about this. But if you go into network.
System preferences, right?
System preferences, network. You will then see on the left side of the screen different interfaces, different network interfaces. And there is, I guess you called it, now I didn't know this, if it's the official name, the widget button.
Yeah, I don't know what to call that. Matt, do you have a name for this thing?
It's a gear with a down arrow that implies, all right, click on this and you'll see some choices. And the choice we like to talk about, unless Matt knows what the heck that's called.
No, I think we're drawing blanks here. I called it a widget. I don't know what else to call it. It's a gear, yeah.
Right, but then and then your choices, when you click on that, one of the choices is it has a dot, 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 which, as we discussed in the past, means that there's going to be another dialogue asking you more stuff versus choices that have no dots mean something's going to happen right now. So set service order, and then it shows you all the interfaces that are defined. You can choose a location, and then you can select the order of in which you would like the services to be accessed. So it's kind of obscure, right?
Yeah, I think so. And
very obscure, but this will accomplish. All right, so if you're on this or if you're in this configuration, try this one first. If you're on this other one, try that first. But
it's easy to do. You just drag them around, and the one at the top is the one that will get priority. So in Brad's case, what you do is you make sure Ethernet is the topmost one, and then that airport is below it, and that way you're sure that it's going to. It's going to do them in that order, unless, of course, you want it differently. But I think for good reason, Brad wants Ethernet to be prioritized. And I do the same thing. I may have mentioned at home, I use a manual IP address, and I have the same IP address assigned to both Ethernet and airport. And this is so I can switch between them while transfers and other things are open and active, and it doesn't blow up those connections. It actually works pretty well. But I have Ethernet at the top, so that when I'm plugged into Ethernet, I'm good to go. So Matt found the answer.
Yeah, it appears to be called the Actions menu. The gear icon.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that's actually listed in Apple's Mobile Me news page. So that's
Action.
From Actions menu. Yeah,
I remember Action Jackson.
I remember Action Jackson. We can't talk about Action Jackson here.
No,
this will get to be like the last time we did an interview together, Matt.
I think we've come beyond that now.
I'm glad. we'd have to work really hard. So the last time Matt and I did any sort of public...
We were in front of a microphone together, sitting down talking.
Talking.
Were
people called?
Well, I think we were interviewed by some person, some poor interviewer that was interviewing us for Go Figure, which was the band that we were in back, you know, that played The Answer, which is the intro song there. And that poor interviewer, I mean, we answered questions he didn't ask. We certainly didn't answer any of his questions.
Not, he had trouble keeping a format to the show and keeping it together personally. I think he had trouble.
I think so. It was good, though. It was good preparation for what we do now in the rest of our lives. Okay, moving on to – so hopefully that helps, Brad, and I think that should solve your problem splendidly. So now I'm finding the show here. Tracy writes in. We talked about the dock quite a bit, and last week we talked about dock spaces was one of the things. And so Tracy writes, and she said, you guys were talking about separate docks per spaces. So I thought I would let you know about an app called Dock Spaces, which is available at the Apple site and at their own site, which we'll put a link into the show notes. So the idea is, John, you had asked last week if you had a different dock as you moved from space to space using Leopard Spaces. And the answer is, by default, no. But using this Dock Spaces app, you can, and it does exactly what you were looking for. So thank you, Tracy. That's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. And then Mark has some things to add, so we're just going to go ahead and let Mark tell us.
So, guys, this is Mark from Arcadia, California, long-time listener, and I love the show. And I'm listening to your podcast that you put out on the 6th of April, and you're talking about the dock and putting spacers in there to divide up your icons. And there's two programs. One's called Deeper, and the other one is called Docker. And I'm pretty sure you can get them at Mac Update or versiontracker.com. And I'm pretty sure they're freeware. And they're great programs. If they're not freeware, they're shareware, and they're very reasonably priced. And I love it. I mean, they both allow you to tweak. Well, Docker allows you to tweak your dock, hence the name, and put in spaces and also tweak the outline of your dock, adding some color to it and a few special effects. And then Deeper basically allows you to dive into not only your dock, but Safari, Spotlight, and a few other little items where you can kind of tweak them around. And both programs are wonderful. I enjoy using them. They make it very easy. And just wanted to pass that along. Love the show, guys, and keep up the great work.
Thanks, Mark. That's awesome. That's fantastic.
Wow.
And you know what else is fantastic, John? We're here at what I like to call the 48-minute mark, and I'm going to try and bring the band in here.
Oh, you brought the band with you? You're nice.
You know, there's two of us sitting right here. and I don't think the rest of the band is findable these days.
No, we might be able to find him.
Matt can find him. Matt's good at hunting for him. Okay. So next show will be show number 200. Look on MacObserver.com on Monday the 27th for information on how to contact us or dial in. I'm honestly not sure how we're going to do it. You know, one option would just be to do a Skype deal, but that gets crazy because we'd have to add it everybody, and I think we're limited. But
there's probably only four or five listeners.
That's true. Yeah, right. for the dozen of you that no. but yeah, I don't know what our limitations are going to be. You know, my guess is we'll probably have, I don't know, who knows? I don't know how many people have. All right. So iPhoneAlley.com is Michael Johnson's home when he is not converting this show. He did not convert 198. He's been sick lately. No. But he says that he's back in action, Jackson. So iPhoneAlley.com. Nice. Yeah. Cashfly.com is the company that provides all the bandwidth to get this show from us to you. The podcast marketplace, of course, includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen and Text Expander from Smile on My Mac, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. Yeah. Don't forget those iTunes comments.
Oh, and there's also, you know, reach out to us, Twitter. Front. Dave is Dave Hamilton. Matt, I don't know.
Do you want the listeners following? He doesn't. He'll stay away from that. That's right. And a Pilot Beat.
This Twitter thing.
Yeah. So you are John F. Braun, correct, John?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you can follow Oprah now.
Okay. I think with that, it's time to fade her out.
No, to me, that's like, has it jumped the shark?
You know, the nice part about Twitter is I can choose who not to follow. So all those illiterate people out there can stay that way. And I'm not saying Oprah's illiterate, actually. I just, you know.
She reads books.
She's very smart. Show number 200 coming up, folks.
Don't get caught.
Made up.